The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Welcome to the Crime Scene, Jim Harold's Crime Scene. So good to be with you once again. Thanks so much for signing up for the Paranormal Plus content. This show has been a real hoot. I mean, I guess some of the things we talk about are pretty sad and pretty tragic, but it's just been very enjoyable for me to talk about some different subject matter rather than just kind of the, I guess, the same old, same old. Not that I don't love paranormal topics. I do. Still my first love. But some of this stuff is pretty strange as well. And that brings us to the case tonight, the rather strange case of H.H. Holmes, America's first serial killer. Actually, I first became acquainted with H.H. Holmes, or the story of H.H. Holmes, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. I was browsing through Netflix, and many of you know that I'm a big fan of Netflix streaming, and I saw this documentary film called H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer. And I watched it, and at the time I was planning on a true crime podcast, so I kept it in the back of my mental file, and I said, when we get started, I've got to see if I can contact the person that made this movie. And luckily, we did it, and he's been gracious enough to be with us. His name is John Borowski, and he is a filmmaker, and he is the man behind that movie that we'll talk about tonight, H.H. Holmes and America's First Serial Killer. He has been that was his first movie, and he's continued on and done some other documentaries, and he has been very, very popular through his company called Waterfront Productions. It's been a great success. I know he's done something called Albert Fish, and we could talk about that a little bit. It's an 86-minute feature docudrama about an elderly cannibal, Albert Fish, who lured children to their deaths in Depression-era New York City. So I think that certainly fits into the category of true crime. We're so glad to have him on the show. He's out of Chicago. John Borowski, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Jim Harold's Crime Scene.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on your show, and I look forward to, you know, talking about H.H. Holmes, another, you know, fascinating true crime cases, which is what I tend to focus on, like pre-1940s, you know, crime or serial killers.
Yeah, it is a fascinating topic, and later on in the show, we want to talk about an event you're having, which actually coincidentally is named Crime Scene. And you didn't know about me and I didn't know about you, but we discovered that tonight. And I want to talk about that a little bit later in the show and how people can connect with that event. Well, let's talk about H.H. Holmes. Now, for people who aren't familiar, give people a thumbnail sketch of who H.H. Holmes was, who he was, when he lived, and what he did.
Yeah, well, H.H. Holmes is to be considered by many people America's first serial killer, and there may have been other American serial killers before him, but there weren't any that had a documented court trial of killing multiple victims at that time period in early American history, late 1890s. So H.H. Holmes was born Herman Webster Mudgett in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, and then he eventually went to medical school at the University of Michigan, and he graduated medical school, and then he came to Chicago. And he was a very ambitious entrepreneur, but unfortunately, instead of turning out to be like a Dale Carnegie or others of that so-called Gilded Age of the early 1880s, he went the diabolical route. So he obviously, when he was in medical school, he gained experiences with working on corpses, and when he was in medical school, he had dabbled with some insurance scams involving having someone take out an insurance policy on their life, and then they would get a body from the medical school and use it in place of the person, and didn't have anything successful at that point. So then he left and came to Chicago, and he wound up working at a drugstore in Chicago's Englewood neighborhood on the South Side, which is not too far from the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. And so then he worked with, at this drugstore with this elderly couple, and they wound up disappearing, and, he said they moved away, and he also at that time got involved with some other insurance scams. Well, he eventually wound up buying this piece of property at the corner of 63rd and Wallace in Chicago in that Englewood neighborhood, which at that time period was filled with prominent doctors and lawyers. Now it's, you know, it's much different, you know, neighborhood. It's more dangerous than, you know, it was back then. I mean, but that's what's so ironic, that he was actually in that neighborhood making it dangerous at that time period. but now it's more, you know, gangsters and, you know, guns going off. And, but, you know, so then anyway, he gets this piece of property, and through all the scamming that he had been doing at that time period, he must have amassed some money in owning that drugstore, and possibly killing the elderly couple that had owned it and willed it to him, or he forced them. You know, there's still a lot of mystery around, you know, because there's not much documentation about his early life prior to,
sure,
you know, his building this building. So he wound up building this huge building at the corner of 63rd and Wallace. It was, you know, two or three floors. It, you know, had not a restaurant. It had a drugstore on the first floor, and like a blacksmith store, a jewelry shop. So the first floor was shops, and the second floors were just, you know, different rooms, you know, which would be his office. And when he was building it, he would hire and fire contractors each day. So no one really knew the layout of this place but him. And so then that was the beginnings of it. And then in 1893, the World's Fair came around, the Chicago World's Fair, where 20 million people visited Chicago to see this massive World's Fair, which is only about 5 miles from where his building was. Some people think he kind of knew that fair was coming, and that's where he chose that location. There's no proof of that, though. So then he rented rooms out in this building to people that visited the World's Fair. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that that's unique in his story, because, you know, he it was almost the perfect confluence of events to go about his diabolical work. Here he happened upon this couple that owned a drugstore. He was able to, one way or the other, wrest control of it. Then he built this large, I guess what later became known as kind of a murder castle, that was built by multiple contractors, and he fired them so often that one didn't know what the other one was doing, so they really didn't, on the whole, nobody knew the big picture what he's building. So he's building this house. All of a sudden, there's this huge event with all of these out-of-towners coming in who had, you know, communication at that time. It wasn't like everybody was carrying an iPhone. People didn't, they wrote letters. So you could lose contact for weeks and not know anything was up. And then he had this huge pool of people to call upon and to kind of drag into his lair. And then he wasn't very nice to his guest, was he?
No, you know, and this, what was found years later, he was actually apprehended in Boston because of a life insurance scam that he, you know, had enacted in Philadelphia. But then once he was apprehended, the Pinkerton detectives, you know, there's more, so much more to the story. But once he was apprehended, you know, they say, well, you know what? He's got that boarded up building back in Chicago. So when the police actually go inside of this building, they, you know, go in his office, and there's a rug, and they lift the rug up, and there's a trap door leading to a secret staircase, which goes all the way down to the basement. And then there's a dumbwaiter shaft with no dumbwaiter in it, but it's just a greased shaft going all the way from the third floor all the way down into the basement. And then when they do go in the basement, they find this crematorium, which he said he used for glass bending, but it's strangely the size of a human body. And then he had quicklime vats and, you know, vats of acid in the basement. They found this bloody dissection table. So what it can, and then further investigation, they would go into his office and see he had a master control panel that had gas lines leading to the individual airtight rooms. So here it came about, okay, well, this guy was renting rooms, and we had many people that disappeared, at least 50, or, you know, who knows how many more were unreported at that time period from all around the world, visitors. And then, you know, so they figured out, okay, so what he must have been doing is killing these people, gassing them in their rooms, taking their money and valuables. Then on top of it, he was, you know, he didn't let anything go to waste. They found out he was selling people's skeletons to universities and medical schools. How he got away with that at that time period, I don't know. Early America, maybe he's a handshake. Hey, I'm a doctor. He's a prominent member of the neighborhood. Who knows? But this was actually happening, and they think one of his mistresses, you know, her skeleton was sold to Minnie Williams. And so, that, you know, it's unbelievable, but he was doing this, and, you know, it's probably factual that he killed at least 9 people, but there's no way of knowing how many more. Could have been 50, could have been hundreds.
And the thing is, and you do really good, and I like the way you do this, because you don't do it in kind of a in the movie, it's not done in a purient way or any kind of sensationalistic way, but you do a recreation, very tastefully done, of when he would literally put people in rooms, he would lock the door, and then he would have controls where he could turn on the gas and literally watch them through a peephole suffocate to death.
Yeah, and again, you know, he must have gotten some enjoyment out of this because it goes back to when he was in medical school working on these cadavers. You know, and that's something he also did with these two little girls, which were, you know, one of his associates' children. He wanted to wipe out the entire family to cover this whole life insurance scam. So he put them in trunks. He, you know, tricked them to get in, these two little girls to get into a trunk, which he had a hole drilled into it. And he took at that time, you know, they had gas lighting. So he took the line and he gassed them in this trunk. Ugh. You know, so, you know, he must have gotten thrills out of, you know, listening to these people suffer. And that, you know, many serial killers, that's what it's all about, domination and control. And, you know, he fit perfectly into that category. But, yeah, it's very frightening. And that's what I wanted to do with the film. You know, it's a very gothic story. And, you know, in my background, I always enjoyed, you know, Edgar Allan Poe and, you know, the old Universal horror films. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if I could, you know, kind of bring that feeling to this film, because it was silent film, you know, I mean, it was before silent film. But if I could bring that silent film style and some of my love of the old Universal horror films, you know, like The Phantom of the Opera or Dracula.
Right.
And you could see that, you know, his basement, I really wanted to make like a tortured dungeon. So there's arched walkways and it looks like a castle, you know. And, you know, so I tried to bring all those elements together. And that's why I selected Tony Jay to do the narration, because if Vincent Price was alive, he would have been doing it.
Right. Right. Yeah, it was a great job of narration. I have to say, very well done, very sinister almost. It kind of added to the overall mood. Now, is there any thought to why Holmes or Mudgett did these things? What in his childhood drove him to do this? Or if anything,
not really.
I'm not saying
There isn't too much evidence. There really isn't much about his childhood. When I went to Gilmanton, New Hampshire to do research, it was interesting. I stayed at a bed and breakfast. That was, you know, Gilmanton, New Hampshire is just this very, you know, small country town. And stayed at the bed and breakfast, and the innkeeper of the bed and breakfast, when I arrived there, he asked me who I was doing a film on. And you know, sometimes I'm a little apprehensive because, you know, when you say, yeah, I'm in your hometown doing a film about, you know, a serial killer from your hometown, you know, some people may not want, you know, to have that, you know, made or that word get out. And, you know, he jumped up right away and he was really excited. He said he used to live right next door. That's his childhood home.
Wow.
So out of the window where I'm staying in this bed and breakfast, you know, where I'm sleeping, I look out the window and here's his childhood home. I mean, it was very creepy. And then I got to meet the owners of that home the next night, and they took us on a little tour of the basement because they had found, when they had done some rehabbing in the home, they had found something in the walls. It was a little piece of brown paper that was like a cutout, and it said Herman's jacket pattern. So that must have been his mother made like this jacket pattern for when he was a child.
Oh, my.
You know, so... yeah, it was very interesting, but really there isn't much known about his childhood. When Holmes was finally apprehended and in prison in Moyamensing in Philadelphia, he wrote his own story, which is really him BSing, trying to say, I'm not a monster. I love these children. Why would I do these things? You know, he was trying to make himself look good because that was before the trial.
Right.
You know, so he wanted the good word of, you know, him being good to get out, but... you know, I tried to find some of the things in there that might be factual, but we still don't know. Like when he was a child, he said some of his friends or, you know, enemies dragged him into this doctor's office and he was terrified by the skeleton. And that also made him also interested in the human body and becoming a doctor or doing some of these things. But really, there's no proof of abuse. He said his father did not spare the rod. So maybe he was somewhat abused when he was a child, but there's really, you know, and not every serial killer is abused, but then again, there's different forms of abuse. You know, some are physical. Maybe Ben Bundy was supposedly not physically abused, but maybe he had some sort of emotional abuse. So, you know, really, you don't know. It's, you know, some people say, you know, a serial killer might have some sort of brain damage or a head injury, but it's still, you know, but that's why I think, you know, we should study these people rather than just execute them immediately to try and find out why they're doing these things, or maybe there is no answer.
I mean, if you look at it, he's kind of the Jeffrey Dahmer in some ways of the 1800s.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he was also created by that time period, because what was happening at that time period where you had these Carnegies and Rockefellers who people said, wow, you know, this is a person just like I am, and I could be them too. And I think Holmes took that to the extreme, the evil extreme, you know, where, you know, he basically did anything, and he killed men, women, children. He would, you know, he had, at the end, it was all money motivated when you really look at it. The life insurance scam where he tried to, you know, destroy the whole family. He would sell the people's skeletons. You know, he would have, you know, his mistresses sign money or property over to him, and then he would kill them. He had three wives at the same time. And I think, and he was highly, highly intelligent. And I think
I was about to say, he's an evil genius.
Yeah, he was. He was a genius, but he was just evil because, you know, people ask me, well, why do you think he didn't kill or harm his wives? Well, he had these three wives, and his last wife was Georgiana Yoke, who, you know, she probably didn't even know much about what was going on, but she was young, so I think, you know, he really did like her because of her age. But then he had his second wife was in Wilmette in the house, which he had her set up in the house with their child. So, you know, of course, when he's arrested, the newspapers, Chicago newspapers, go to the wife and say, well, you know, what do you know about this building with all these torture things in it? And she says, well, you know, I don't know anything about that, his business. I'm here in my home. He's never hurt me or my child. But, you know, I think he was such a forward thinker. He had her. She was just a pawn, too, because why would she say anything bad about him when she's set up in this nice big house in Wilmette and being taken care of? You know, I mean, she may have known some of these things, but, you know, I think he had her in place, and then he killed his mistresses for money or property. It was, you know, he was just, you know, and then when you think about it, he's running these businesses, running this building, working with three wives, working with mistresses, going to the World's Fair, you know, even at that time period. And like you're saying, there are no iPhones, there are no internet, there's no computers. He did so many things for the limitations, but then he also used those limitations, you know, to his benefit.
Well, something, and I can't remember if it was a historian or someone that you interviewed in the movie made the very good point. Somebody's visiting, I believe it was it called the Columbiana Exposition or something like that?
And yeah, the Columbian Exposition, yeah.
And they're visiting, they're from St. Louis or wherever, and they say to their family, hey, I'm going to Chicago to go to the World's Fair. And then a month later, 2 months later, they don't come back. And basically, the family's left to think, well, they went to Chicago and they never came back. And there's no real way to trace. It's not like now, it's not, you can't put out an Amber Alert. I mean, I know that's for children, but you get the point. You can't put an APB. There's no way to really track people. There's no credit card statements, nothing like that. So basically they go into this void that is the World's Fair. They pick up their newspaper. They see an ad for some lodging. Quite innocently, they go to this place, which I guess Holmes furnished with things he had bought via mail order, via credit. He had no intention of paying. And all of a sudden, they're gone and nobody's any of the wiser. So as you said, he not only did a lot with the limitations he was under in terms of technology, he utilized those limitations to prey on people. And again, I don't want to make it like we're glorifying this man. We're not. I mean, obviously, it's heinous. It's terrible. He obviously pretty much got what he deserved by being hanged. But that being said, he was an evil genius.
Well, right. And I think, you know, we also have to look at it from the perspective of he was, you know, one of the, you know, forefathers of the wave of serial killers that were to come, you know, because, you know, before him, again, there may have been some here and there, but they really didn't have these documented court cases.
Right.
And, you know, you are right though. And at that time, those limitations were, you know, the, you know, country, you could go from one state to another and change your identity. They, you know, the police forces didn't communicate with each other. So once you stepped over that border, you're Henry Holmes or Herman Mudgett or Harry Howard or whoever you wanted to be. No driver's license, no social security card. I mean, it's very, and, you know, also the lack of forensics at that time. You know, it was even difficult for them to identify blood as human or animal, let alone who it was from. I mean, there was no DNA testing. So that's why these early stories fascinate me as well, because many of them are solved by tried and true detective work. The cases that are unsolved don't really, interest me too much. But like these, you know, there was the one Detective Geyer who went to try and find these children that Holmes was supposedly with after this life insurance scam. He went door to door because Holmes had kept one of the little girls, the letters that she had written to her mother. You know, I mean, he was just, you know, awful, and he had kept these letters. But this Detective Geyer from Philadelphia went to all those locations on those letters with photos of the children and Holmes, knocked on every door in those areas and said, "Have you seen this man? Have you seen these children?" Until finally someone said, "Yes, we did. They were, you know, in the house next door or whatever." And, you know, it's like, yeah, forget it. Like you're saying, you know, he didn't jump on the internet. You can't just make a map quest. It was, he traveled by foot and maps.
Oh, absolutely amazing. Let me ask you this. Why do you think there's not been a bigger deal made of him over the period of time? Why aren't we more aware of him?
I think because he was, you know, almost, when you think about it, the worst of the worst, because even some of our modern serial killers, like, you know, ever since we, you know, the term was created by the FBI in the 70s for, you know, people such as John Wayne Gacy and, you know, others, Ted Bundy, we've been aware of these killers. But I think, you know, what he did was just so heinous, and in his mind to create really a building for disposing, purely made for disposing of people. I mean, that's really what it was. It was a murder castle, murder factory, he's called the torture doctor. And that's one of the reasons why I think it was just so heinous. People just wanted to put it behind them. And I think sometimes that's a normal reaction to some of these things, out of sight, out of mind. That's why, his building was, you know, almost burned down, whether it was by people he worked with trying to cover things up, or outraged locals. That's what happened to the Ed Gein farm in the 50s in Wisconsin. You know, his farm was burnt down by people that were probably like, you know what, we just don't even want this to exist anymore. It was just so awful. We don't even want to think about it. We don't want to hear about it anymore. Because after, you know, the early 1900s, there was no mention of Holmes, really. I mean, there were some pulp novels that came out until the early 1970s when the book Torture Doctor came out by David Frank. And then after that, there were several other books. And, of course, you know, the big Eric Larson book, Devil in the White City, was out, too.
Right.
And, you know, that brought this renewed interest. And my film came out at around that time period as well. So I think, you know, between, you know, my film and that book, it brought this renewed interest in it. And now Leonardo DiCaprio is going to be producing and, I guess, starring in the film of Devil in the White City.
Oh, and is he going to be playing the H.H. Holmes character?
I believe he is, but, you know, he's a little old. I mean, Holmes,
you know, I was wondering that. Yeah, he was only 34, although he looks old in the pictures.
Yeah.
Well, actually, DiCaprio, though, if you think the Tom Hanks movie produced for him, Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, he always looks younger.
Yeah. So I actually think he would do a great job in that movie, although I think he would be quite chilling, but I think that's the appropriate playing of that. But I think he could pull that off. I think he'd be quite good at it. I guess, and some of these things are just senseless, and there is no lesson to be learned. Is there anything, I don't want to say anything positive, but is there anything that we can learn from the H.H. Holmes case?
Well, from his case, I'm not sure, and that was even the most difficult part about it. I mean, obviously, you know, they're trying to be as aware as you can, and, you know, judge people's character before you get in a little too deep, because I think the main crowd, the main demographic of the Holmes story is actually female. And that's why I think that book Devil in the White City was such a big hit, and the reason I believe that is because I think women wonder, well, what was it about this guy that he could keep having these mistresses? I mean, he wasn't a billionaire at that time. You know, he had money, but he wasn't rich, you know. I mean,
right.
He wasn't too attractive. So you think, well, how did he have these wives and all these mistresses and all these people? And, you know, I think they wonder what it was about this man. And he obviously had to be very charismatic and charming. You know, and he was a little guy. He was like 5'4", 5'6". He was short. He wasn't like a tall, handsome guy. So you're thinking, what about him? You know, and you know, so I think, again, just trying to have this awareness and look for some of these early warning signs like his last wife. Obviously, he's taking her on this cross-country journey, you know, coming back, you know, sweating and, you know, leaving at all hours of the night, you know, instead of saying, well, that's just his business, you know, be a little smarter and really try and figure out there's something going on here that isn't right. You know, so maybe it's that, but, you know, and that's why I really couldn't think of anything to, you know, end the film on other than, you know, he quoted when he wrote his own story, he said that, you know, he was born in Devil's Image or whatever, but I couldn't think of anything to really, you know, understand, you know, any way to understand or explain why he did these things. So that's why I just used that at the end of the film, because it was so diabolical. It's like, well, I, you know, and that's why with his story and with these other stories too, I just try and tell the story as well as I can and lay all the cards on the table and let the viewers decide maybe it was this, maybe it was that, you know, and, you know, have the viewer also try and, you know, determine, you know, why he may have done these things. So I try and take an objective view and just put all the, you know, information out there, but I try to make it at least somewhat entertaining rather than just, you know, talking head interviews and photographs, right. You know, try and make it more cinematic.
Right. And I think you did a very good job on it, and it was fascinating. I mean, obviously it got my interest. I contacted you for this interview, and it is a frightening but fascinating case. Now, since I have you on the line, I was looking through your website, and I mentioned it in the intro, this other documentary you've done on Albert Fish. Now, I'm not familiar. Can you tell us who he was and what he did?
Yeah, Albert Fish, really, he began his serial killing career. He's unique in many ways. He was an elderly serial killer, but he didn't start his serial killing career probably well into his 40s, which is strange. He dabbled in S&M before that, and, you know, most likely, you know, he obviously enjoyed pain. But, you know, again, sometimes with some of these serial killers, you could see, you know, how childhood and their environment have created them to be what they were, because when he was a child, he was in an orphanage. And in this orphanage, you know, when they would punish the children, they would force the children to watch other children being, you know, spanked and, you know, with a belt on their bare behind. And they also did that to him. And he actually started to enjoy both of those after a while. He liked watching it, and he enjoyed having it done to him. And that's what created this whole enjoyment of S&M. And he would write letters to newspapers, you know, looking for other people to fulfill those fantasies. But eventually he started killing little children because he liked to torture them and hear their cries. And this was during the Depression era in New York City. Albert Fish was the original stranger danger. At that time period, people would let their children play. I mean, you know, you see film footage from that time period, which I have in my film. There are, you know, 3-year-old to 8-year-old children playing on the street, unattended. No, you know, at that time period, it was totally different. There was no stranger danger. So these parents would be doing their thing, and these kids would be on the street playing, or going, you know, in alleys doing things. So here's Albert Fish coming along with some candy to lure them into a basement to strangle them. And so he was the original boogeyman. Even one of the children called him the boogeyman when they saw him take another kid, you know, up a fire escape. They said, you know, it was the boogeyman.
Now, I mean, I think is he best known for being a cannibal?
Yes. Yeah. That's so what he did was Fish wasn't highly intelligent. He wasn't like an H.H. Holmes. Fish was more cunning. He was a very cunning serial killer. So he would always look in these newspapers. And at that time period, you know, they had matrimonial ads, people looking to get married. You know, there would be all these different types of ads in the newspaper. So he came across this ad by the Butt family that said, you know, we have a teenage boy that could help you out with any needs you may have, you know, lifting things, painting, whatever. So he answered that ad. And he went to their house, and, you know, he, of course, his intention was, he said, to take this boy and castrate him and kill him. But when he went to their house, for some reason, he was enamored by this little girl they had called Grace Budd. So when he gets to the house, he said, I own this farm on Long Island. He flashes some cash. He tries to impress these people, which, of course, they, you know, they lived in a stark basement apartment in poor New York. So they're kind of, you know, hoping that their son will get this job, you know, so they want to impress this guy. So they will, you know, get some extra cash. So then he comes up with a story and says, well, let me take your daughter to this party at such and such street my granddaughter is having. She'll have a great time and I'll bring her back later. Well, they let him take her. You know, they say, okay, yeah, you could, for whatever reason, they let this stranger take their daughter.
Yeah, that's
nuts. And of course, she never comes. No, yeah, and she never comes back. You know, and that's why Albert Fish, you know, later, which is, you know, unbelievable, but it's almost true. He said, well, it wasn't kidnapping. They let me take her, you know. And so anyway, their daughter is missing, gone. Now, you know, 4 years go by. And there's a mention of it, you know, that there was this one detective, William King in New York, who, again, here's the tried and true detective work. He was on this case. He tried to do as much as he could. So 4 years later, you know, he thought, okay, you know what? There was actually a picture in the newspaper that spurred someone to write in and say, well, that's, you know, that's her. That's that Grace Budd. Look, she's older. She's still alive. So that showed that people were still interested in this case 4 years later. So then William King went to Walter Winchell, who was this big columnist in New York in the gossip column.
Right.
He had him put a little, you know, bait in that column. Well, the column worked because the Grace Budd's mother received this letter in the mail. So she opens this letter, and it's a whole letter describing how Albert Fish took her daughter on that day, where he took her to in upstate New York, how he killed her by strangling her, how he cut pieces of her body off, how he took pieces of her body back to his apartment, and exactly how he cooked her, boiled it, and baked it in the oven, you know, in graphic detail. Yeah. So then, of course, that's turned over to the police, and what they do is there's this letterhead on the envelope, and it was tracked down to this boarding house where Fish had stayed at one point, and he was coming back to pick up a check. So that's when the detective said, all right, call us. You know, he goes to a boarding house to call us when he comes back. Fish comes back. The detective apprehends him. And then when they catch him, he starts confessing, and he takes him to this house called Wisteria House in upstate New York, you know, where he took the girl into and, you know, strangled her there. And then, you know, when he's apprehended, he says, well, I also punish myself as penance for killing these children, because he had a religious dementia. He thought he was doing good by killing these children and sending them straight to heaven, and he would drink their blood.
Oh,
so with him, it was very much like the blood and flesh of Christ, you know, with communion. In his mind, he took it literally. So they didn't believe him, the authorities. So they take him to a hospital, and they took an x-ray of his abdomen, and on this x-ray, which is in the Library of Congress, 29 needles, sewing needles, some as small as 1 inch to 3 inches, show up and stuck inside his abdomen.
Ugh.
So he would stick these needles into his body. I mean, Albert Fish is a fascinating case of how a human being could live this life of perversion, because at that time period, they had to create some of these abnormalities up that weren't even on the books just for him. You know, they didn't have enough of them. I mean, I think it was like 18. Of 18 abnormalities, you know, in addition to cannibalism and all these other, you know, abnormalities. I mean, it was just, so that's why I was fascinated by this case as well. There's the tried and true detective work, but no one could compare to his depravity. Even H.H. Holmes, I mean, what this guy did to himself and other children was just awful.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to put them on a scale, but I got to say that H.H. Holmes sounded pretty good compared to this guy.
Yeah.
Well, it is certainly a fascinating topic. I got to say it's disturbing, but it is fascinating. And I know that, you know, this is kind of your career, and you're very much into this topic. And I know that you have this event coming up. I believe it's in May. So tell us about what the name is and what the event is and what's going to be going on.
Yeah, the event is called The Crime Scene, and it's going to be on May 28th in Indianapolis, Indiana. And it really began, its inception began when I was filming for a documentary that I'm planning to produce. I'm working on a documentary called Serial Killer Culture, which focuses on artists such as musicians, authors, that do works inspired by crime or killers, because, you know, we know there are many of them out there. There are bands that do songs on them. There are authors that write books on them. There are people who paint, you know, about them, like Joel Coleman. So I thought that would make a fascinating documentary. So Matthew Aaron owns the Last Dime Museum in Indianapolis, Indiana, and what he has on display are, you know, artworks by serial killers, artifacts from them, other oddities, you know, like carnival circus atmosphere oddities as well, like a two-headed rat, things like that. You know, he's like, him and Joe Coleman, you know, are very similar in that respect, that they, you know, collect these things and they also do artwork on them. So when I went there to interview him, and I also interviewed Joe Hiles, who runs skcentral.com, which is, you know, was an early site created, you know, and it has all this information about serial killers. And so we were there, and Matthew said, well, we should do some event that, you know, is a day-long event, you know, about true crime, but it's more, you know, it's not, you know, we're not focusing on the depravity, but we're focusing on, you know, these artists that are inspired by these events. You know, so we have, I'm going to be there, Matthew and Joe, and then we have, you know, there's an author that wrote a book on Northcott, which that movie was based. There was a Clint Eastwood movie that was based on that story. And we have, you know, bands and musicians, and there are going to be, you know, actual items on display, you know, such as serial killer artwork or true crime artifacts, things like that. So it's going to be a whole night that's just focusing on true crime. We'll have speakers and, you know, so the focus is pretty wide, but it's also just focusing on true crime.
Well, it is a fascinating topic. I'm new to it. You know, obviously over the years I've read a lot of books and things, but I thought we'd been doing paranormal programs for the years, and I thought this was a natural extension. And I thank you for educating us about H.H. Holmes and for taking some time to be on the crime scene. And where can people go on the net to find out more information about everything that you do?
Yeah, my website is really the hub. It's johnborowski.com. And through that site, you know, it's the hub for all my films, but each one of my film sites, you know, exists as well. So you can just type in like H.H. Holmes film or Albert Fish film. And my latest film is on Carl Panzram. So you could also check that out through the other sites.
Well, thank you so much, John. Thank you for being on the crime scene.
Thank you so much, too. I look forward to hopefully being on again in the future.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in and for signing up for the Plus podcast. And, you know, I'm trying to think of a signature line for this show, but I guess I'll steal one from Hill Street Blues. Be careful out there. We'll talk to you next time on Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Bye-bye.